Thanks, Brian. It's great to be with you all again this morning, and I just got to say, you guys have a wonderful church. The spirit that is here at Trinity Pres is delightful, and if you don't know how good you have it, let me be the one to tell you. No church is perfect, but a lot of wonderful things are happening here, so praise God for that, and I'm glad that y'all get to enjoy the blessing of the Lord's work. This morning I want to talk about emotional health, and that's a term that may or may not be familiar to you. It also goes by the phrase emotional intelligence or emotional quotient, or just EQ for short. And it's a term that's borrowed from advances in studies in neuroscience. So it's a term that's been brought into the church from brain science and neuroscience, and yet a lot of what it's identifying have, just because we know that are bring things that intersect well with what the scriptures teach us, although we haven't done that work, that conversation work, as much as perhaps we should. Emotional health specifically is referring to one's ability to be aware and manage our emotions in the context of others' emotions and relationships. So it has two sides to it. It's that personal awareness of what's going on inside of us, how we're doing, what we're feeling, and how that's affecting us, but also that awareness outside of us, the emotions of others, and how we're inhabiting those relationships. And Pete Scazzaro, I'm going to refer to Pete Scazzaro a lot today because he's done a lot of work in this conversation for the church. His perhaps most important book was his first book, The Emotionally Healthy Church. That's one of those books that I would recommend to you. He says that what we need in the church is a Copernican revolution. And I think there's lots of things that we need a Copernican revolution in the church regarding. But one of them, he says, is in relation to emotional health. And his thesis in that book is our level of spiritual maturity, so the Christian's maturity, is no longer able to be abstracted from or divorced from a conversation about emotional health. He says that it's impossible for us to be spiritually mature and remain emotionally immature. That's really what he's getting at. In fact, all of his studies, all of his books, he's now written about five or six, they're really all exploring that thesis, that spiritual maturity is intimately linked to emotional maturity. Now, I just want to speak a little bit about some background on this topic of emotional health. As I said, it's a term that's borrowed from advances and studies in brain science, and some of you may be neuroscientists, you know this better than me, and I'm certainly not going to do a deep dive into the science of emotional intelligence. I just want to give you a cursory understanding that that when we think about who we are as people, in maybe years ago, we tended to think in terms of the thinking part of who we are, our rational selves. And so a lot of brain science was focused on the prefrontal cortex. That's where we engage in our rational faculties, our thinking faculties. And yet brain science began to realize that when a person is in a heightened state, perhaps under threat or engaging in fear, even if it's chronic, it's not acute, a different part of the brain is sort of lit up. And it's the more interior part of the brain that's referred to as the limbic system. And that system actually, in certain circumstances, particularly when we're experiencing threat or fear, the fight or flight mechanism is engaged in a person that it basically shuts down our thinking part of the brain. Right, we stop thinking and we're feeling. We stop thinking and we start reacting. And what's fascinating about that is that part of our brain is exerting far more control over what's happening in our lives than we tend to think. And in fact, sometimes we can be functioning in a heightened emotional state and not even know it. We may think that we're being rational, but in fact, this more interior part of our brain is exerting a lot more control over who we are. Our ability to be aware of that conversation between our thinking and emotions is a big part of emotional intelligence, or EQ. This conversation has been around for a long time, going back to 1995. Time magazine had a cover story on emotional intelligence. Some of you weren't even around at that time, but it said this: it's not your IQ, it's not even a number. The emotional intelligence may be the best indicator of success in life, redefining what it means to be smart. Now, research suggested, perhaps in a previous generation or two, that the greatest predictor in our success was our IQ, how smart we are. And the more intelligent we are, then the greater success we have in life. And the problem with that thesis was that it didn't correlate to the data. It didn't make sense to the data, because consistently what people saw is people with the highest IQs didn't perform well in life. And in fact, people with average IQs were outperforming people who had higher IQs. The studies found that people with average IQs outperform people with the highest IQs 70% of the time. 70% of the time. People with high IQs outperform people with average IQs only 20% of the time. And people couldn't make sense of that until we began to understand the concept of emotional intelligence and realized that what people are doing in relationship is a far bigger predictor of success in life, however you might term that. You know, your family stays together, you hold a job, your marriage is stable, you're able to do the things that we tend to think of as stability. And in fact, EQ now is regarded as the single biggest predictor of performance in the workplace, the strongest driver of leadership and personal excellence. So important is this concept of emotional health. They go on, of all the people we've studied at work, we found that just 90% of high performers are also high in EQ. On the flip side, just 20% of low performers are high in EQ. You can be a high performer without EQ, but the chances are slim. So I say all of that to give you a background of the conversation outside of the church. That's the secular conversation. And yet when we bring this conversation into the church, it's often met suspiciously. It's often met suspiciously. And that's fascinating to me, because as we think about our emotions, obviously God gave us emotions. We'll talk about that in a minute. But we have a lot of baggage when it comes to emotion in the church, right? Because from an early age, many of us have been taught to be suspicious of our emotions, right? Emotions are irrational. Emotions are childish. Emotions are signs of weakness. Emotions can interfere with getting what you really want. Emotions are not always reliable. We need to get rid of emotions. And we need to shut emotions down. Leighton Ford, a Christian leader in the evangelical world from an earlier generation, in reflecting on his own training as a pastor and as a ministry leader, he said this about emotions as he was sort of coming up in the world. Emotions were discounted in much of the evangelical teaching I had heard growing up. We were taught about facts, faith, and feelings in that order. Faith was to be based on the facts of the Christian message, an essential emphasis to be sure, but we should not rely on feelings because they were unreliable, secondary, and untrustworthy. There's no reason for us to talk about emotions, in other words. We don't have to be preoccupied with emotions. They aren't giving us significant information. One scholar, reflecting on the Christian's prejudice against emotions, because we feel scared by them, says this: when someone starts expressing a negative emotion, many of us, as a matter of habit, try to talk people out of that emotion. When someone shares with us that they're sad, how many of us immediately say, "Oh, don't be sad. Things aren't that bad." Because we don't want there to be sadness. We don't want that emotion to exist. We try to help others, he says, see why they need not continue in the place of sadness or anger. Sometimes those in the church are especially prone to do so. We feel Christians should have the joy of the Lord in our hearts. And we're concerned that emotions like anger, sadness, fear, anxiety, they can lead us away from God. Emotions threaten us. They threaten us. Ironically, that anxiety about emotion may borrow more from an Enlightenment viewpoint than a biblical one. This emphasis upon the rational thinking part of being a human being is probably more about a prejudice to secular Enlightenment and modernity than it is what the scriptures actually teach us about the human person. So we can go all the way back to Descartes, whom some would regard as the father of the Enlightenment. He was the one who said, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. And that was sort of his fundamental thesis about what it meant to be a human being. The thinking self. This is who we are. In essence, what a human being is a thinking thing. And so it was Descartes that crowned reason and rationality as king. And there begins at least one expression of that prejudice against our emotional life. You can't trust them. It's not important. It's not part of what it means to be a human being. It's no longer necessary. And so humanity got reduced to the proverbial, and now some philosophers will say this, using this metaphor to describe this problem: we're just heads on a stick. That's all we are as human beings, heads on sticks. That the only thing that matters is that rational part of our lives. And Christians unwittingly embrace that Enlightenment view of the human person when we think that all that matters about being a person in the church or a Christian in the church is what we're thinking about. And we're really good at that in the church. And we have passages that help us defend that. One is the passage we didn't look at last night, but the same chapter, Romans chapter 12, that we're transformed by the renewing of our minds, which is exactly true. But we oversimplify what Paul is getting at. We narrow our concern, and what we interpret that to mean is that we're transformed when we memorize a bunch of Bible passages, and then we regurgitate them. And we listen to more sermons. And we go to more Bible studies. And we just keep downloading information in the hopes that it will change us. And we think the Christian life is really about the management of information. And And we don't have a more holistic, dynamic understanding of the process of change and how it's related to relationships and how it's so deeply connected to a bigger view of the human person. And I got great good news for us this morning. We're not computers. We're not machines. We're people. But we are suspicious of the conversation about emotional health. And anything, if a conversation's begun out there in the world, we need to be careful about making sure we're integrating that conversation in light of biblical truth and biblical authority. Don't misunderstand me. But ironically, we've already done an unhealthy integration related to the Enlightenment. And we've imported ideas that are actually foreign to the Scriptures. And we're discounting the conversation that God wants us to have about our emotions. And so I just want to ask us some key questions. We can't read that, can we? Can anybody read that? Okay, so I guess I'll read them for us. I hope what I've said so far is resonating with you a little bit. Even if it's uncomfortable, you're like, yeah, that's kind of true. So I want to ask a harder question. How many of you are satisfied with your level of spiritual maturity as indicated? Your level of spiritual maturity as indicated by your personal joy and devotion to the Lord. Your personal joy and devotion. Are you satisfied? That's an emotion, your joy in the Lord. Is it there? Secondarily, how many of you are satisfied with your spiritual maturity as indicated by your love and service to others without concern for what you might receive in return? How many of you are satisfied with your level of spiritual maturity, with your joy and devotion to the Lord, and your love and concern for others without regard for what you might receive in return? Any of you satisfied? Because you probably need to come up here and teach the rest of the seminar. Like, but we know a lot of stuff. We know a lot of stuff. And yet so let's just be honest. Okay, we accept that we're not where we want to be. And then that introduces a problem. How do we fix that? How do we change? And so this is the next question. Why are the solutions to this problem always read more, think more clearly about the Christian life, and believe the gospel more? Nothing wrong with those things. We absolutely need to commit ourselves to Scripture. We absolutely need to think more clearly about the gospel. That's one of the things we're doing here today. But we do it in a simplistic way, and we avoid certain parts of that conversation, and we end up just retreading the same conversation. I wonder if that's part of the reason why we're stuck. Because we're not adding anything else to the conversation. We're not exploring our lives in the depth with a kind of holistic point of view that the Scriptures are wanting us to have. So, third question, does your emotional inner world, so the conversation that only you know about, maybe if you are in a close, intimate relationship, you've begun to share some of that emotional inner world with somebody else, maybe a counselor. But does your emotional inner world, if you're honest, reflect your intellectual grasp of the gospel? Why not? Why isn't that true? Is it possible that there's more going on inside of ourselves, inside of us, what it means to be a human person, than we want to admit? And I absolutely want to say yes to that question. There's more going on. There's a lot more going on as what it means to be a human person. And so what we need is to revisit a Christian view of the self that requires us to integrate our emotional lives. We need a Christian view of the self that requires us to take into account our emotions. And again, this wasn't always true in the church. We didn't always say, hey, let's don't care about the soul. Let's don't think about our spirits. Let's disregard our emotions. John Calvin, for one, spoke about the Psalms as a guide to the soul. This is part of what he argued the purpose of the Psalter was in the Scriptures, to lead us into the part, that emotional part of what it means to be a human person. He said the Psalter is an anatomy of the soul, all parts of the soul. So many of us, when we read the Psalter, are just kind of like, okay, thanks. Let's go back to Paul. Because we're reading about all that, like, we don't know how to parse that. We don't know how to parse the Psalms of lament. Because it calls us to engage and do self-work that we would rather avoid. And we're much more comfortable in the epistles, because of the information it provides us. Not all of you resonate with it, but some of you do. And one scholar says this: all the range of emotions are expressed in the Psalms. The Psalms weave an emotional fabric for the human soul. These inspired lyrics take us by the hand and train us in proper emotion. They lead us to emotional maturity. Which I love that. I love that idea. And we're not going to do a series on the Psalms, although that would be a great outcome of this, you know, to do that. But what I do want to do is just do some reflective work on why we should think about emotions as part of the conversation on spiritual maturity and spiritual transformation. And so we need to just go back and do a quick theology lesson on the Christian view of the self. And so that means we need to think about who we are as those made in the image of God. God obviously made us, Genesis 1 and 2. The psalmist says we're fearfully and wonderfully made. And what the Bible teaches us about the formation of the self is that we are both body and spirit, united in a wonderful, holistic person that the Scriptures teach us is made in the image of God. Anthony Hookema, he writes about this: though the Bible does see man as a whole, it also recognizes that a human being has two sides, physical and non-physical. He has a physical body, but he also has a personality. He has a mind with which he thinks, but also a brain which is part of his body and without which he cannot think. Man is one person, man in one person, who can, however, be looked at from two sides. The advantage of this expression, psychosomatic unity, is that it does full justice to the two sides of man while stressing man's unity. And that's a theological definition. That's a theologian for you. But what Anthony Hookema is saying is that the spirit encompasses all of these things, the inner workings of the human person, our thinking, but also our feeling faculties. That's part of what it means to be a human being. So our humanity, our humanness, includes our emotionality. And sometimes we forget that. Sometimes we forget that God made us as emotional beings. We might think, well, yeah, God made us to think things through. He made us rational. He made us to be in relationship with him, to be spiritual. And then we just kind of like, yeah, feelings, I don't know, that's in some door that I don't want to enter. But no, that's part of who we are as well. That's part of who God made us to be. And what I would just argue is can we fully embrace God's teaching on being a human being made in the image of God and ignoring or de-emphasizing our emotional capacities? Can we do that? Should we do that? Should we say that part of who we are is just unimportant? So let me just apply it a little bit. Should Adam have been excited when he saw Eve? Now, Hebrew scholars tell us the first poetry in the Bible is when Adam saw Eve. Now at last. Bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. It's a poem. It's a song. That's the first love song in the Bible. It's emotional. So is that a problem? Is that something that shouldn't be in the Bible? Is that just like cold calculating? Now bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh. That is woman. No. There's something beautiful about the emotionality. When Adam looked at all the animals, said, there's not a partner for me, and it begged the question, what's going on here, God? Do you think he felt anything? Or is this just like, you know, the taxonomy here, God, is not working out. We need to do something about this. No, there's more to it, right? We understand that. That was part of the pre-fall condition. There is this sense of the emotionality that is part of our being created in the image of God. But of course, that emotionality has also been affected by the fall. And perhaps this is where we get tripped up about our emotions, because just like the fall has affected every other aspect of the human person and all of the facets of this world, so it has affected our emotions. And this is where jealousy and fear, rage, anger, sadness, all of these things come in because of the fall. And Dan Allender, Trimper Longman, I spoke about them last night. The difficulty we attach to darker emotions, that they say, is one of the reasons why we don't want to feel. Because that feeling exposes the tragedy of our world and the darkness of our hearts. No wonder we don't want to feel. Feelings expose the illusion that life is safe, good, and predictable. The truth is, we not only want to avoid discussing emotions like these, anger, anxiety, sadness, jealousy, despair, we also want to pretend that they don't exist. Just hope they go away. But the Bible is pushing us to think about this. The prophet Jeremiah, what did Jeremiah say? He said, the heart is desperately sick, right? Desperately sick. Who can understand it? Again, Allender and Longman, emotions vocalize the inner workings of our soul and so are tainted as every other portion of our personality. But they go on and say, despite that, our emotions vocalize the inner workings of our soul. And so, in a sense, our emotions are vital links to our internal and our external worlds. Our emotions are like this little periscope. that's telling us something is going on underneath the surface. That's what our emotions are linking those worlds. And in fact, that's exactly what's happening in our brain. But that's their argument. And when we have those negative, darker emotions, and you can imagine how we respond. I mean, I'm sure Brian's preached tons of sermons on how we're idolaters, right? And how we follow Adam into his sin. I just want to give us two categories. We deny and we demand. We deny and we demand. And one of the reasons why we deny is because it helps shut down this whole conversation. Some of you right now are like, okay, will he just shut up? I do not want to have this conversation. Why? Why do we not want to have this conversation? Why do we want to push it back? Sometimes when we're thinking about this conversation, we will say, well, what are you feeling? And we will say, I don't feel anything. I don't feel anything. And so is that true? Or is that, I've so numbed my heart to this conversation that I don't have to have it. And I've convinced myself that that's safer than having the conversation. And so that, I'm suggesting, is actually, that's an emotional response that's rooted in denial. Sometimes, even for those of us who are the touchy-feely types, and we're just gushing our emotion, but it has a superficial kind of ring to it. It's loud and out, but it's not deep. Not really doing the work. So there can even be a denial in that regard too. So denial is one of the ways that we manage emotion as a consequence of the fall. Another way of saying is we hide. Who else hid? This is what Adam, this is Genesis 3, guys. They hid. We're good hiders. The other thing we do is we demand, right? We demand that the people around me adjust to meet and satisfy my needs in a million different ways that are unique to our individual story and the individual relationships that we inhabit. And oftentimes, that demanding, the way we know that demandingness is there is when our needs aren't met. When we experience that in relationships and a need or a longing or a desire is not met, boom, we spike, right? We jump. And there's emotion. What is that? Pizzicazzaro calls that demandingness, that consequence of the influence of sin in our emotional lives, and an excessive demanding heart as being emotional children or emotional adolescents. So let's just think a little bit about how that might look. Why is it so hard when someone disagrees with me? Have you ever been in a meeting and, you know, there's just that one person? And they're just like, nope. And you lose. You're like, and it's not like, well, we, you know, it didn't happen today. It's like your day is wrecked. And you go into this self-talk of, I'm not worth anything, or I'm a failure, or my world is coming apart. Pastors do that, by the way. Why does that happen? Why are we so threatened? Why do we take it so personal? Another question, why do I focus on individuals and have expectations that they will never be able to fulfill? Why do I imagine that you will be able to resolve all of the issues of my loneliness? And then I'm going to give you a prescription to meet all of my needs about feeling lonely. Here's what you need to do. You need to ask me these questions when you get home. You need to spend time with me. We need to have these dates. Here's the list. And then we try to do the list, and it doesn't work. Or we skip one part, and then we're back on the treadmill of how you didn't meet the need. Why do we believe that one person will be able to meet that need? And let's just pull the lens back a little bit. Why do we think another person is supposed to meet my emotional needs? Any of them? Where did I get that? Where did I get the idea that another person is going to be able to satisfy all of my longings, all of my undealt with desires? And all of that, of course, we could frame it as idolatry. We could frame it as sin. But one of the things I want us to see this morning is that is all bound up with the emotional side of the human person. And to see that as the theater of where our idolatry is occurring. And typically we don't think of it that way. We abstract it. It's idolatry. We need to stop being idolaters. And so we don't explore the specific emotions. Why are these my emotions? Why are these the things that I'm feeling? Why does that happen in the context of these relationships? The Proverbs, again, from the Scriptures, a man without self-control is like a city broken into and without walls. You know, when we don't have self-control, we tend to be emotionally unhinged. And the Proverbs are suggesting that that's like a city that's been ravaged, broken into, a war zone. So when we're not mature in our emotions, it's like our inner world is a war zone. It's like our inner world has been ravaged because we're not stewarding that part of our personhood. This is what the fall has done to our emotional selves. And we don't really move the ball forward by ignoring that conversation. So we need to pay attention to the ways our emotional selves are demanding. Because our emotions are vocalizing the inner working of ourselves. And they're linking our external and our internal worlds. That's one of the prime insights of Dan Allender, Tremper Longman in their book, Bold Love. And also their book, The Cry of the Soul, which is a study of the Psalms, the darker emotions of the Psalms. So we also need to think about redemption. And this passage from John 11 is the passage where Mary and Martha have summoned Jesus because Lazarus has fallen ill and Jesus is in another town. And as Jesus hears this news, he says, John reminds us, now Jesus loved Martha and her sister Lazarus. Now he went on and stayed in the town a couple more days. Lazarus dies, as you know. He comes back to the town, to Bethany, and he encounters Martha, and Martha's like, if you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. And then Mary comes to him and says the same thing. If you had been here, my brother wouldn't have died. She's weeping. And guess who else begins to weep? Jesus. Jesus weeps. Right, we know from Sunday school, this is the shortest verse in the Bible. That's what we remember about this passage. We've got the facts. We haven't thought much about the fact that Jesus wept. Jesus entered into that emotion. Jesus entered into that moment, even though he was going to resurrect them. I mean, why would he go to the business of weeping? We're going to fix it. Like, it's going to all be fine. What? Why? Because that's reflective of the incarnational work of our redemption. We aren't redeemed by facts. We aren't redeemed by figures. We aren't redeemed by a contract. We aren't redeemed by some mathematical formula. It didn't happen that way. It happened in the context of a human being who bore all of the emotions that we have, the wholeness of our personhood. Jesus took that upon himself and he fully entered into it. And the narratives of the gospel are helping us see the beauty of Jesus' incarnational work. We're redeemed in the context of Jesus, his whole being. He entered into all of what we have to negotiate, and he dignifies it. He dignifies the brokenness of it and the beauty of it. Again, Dan Allen or Tremper Long, we're not machines that can be repaired through a series of steps. We are relational beings who are transformed by the mystery of relationships. The preeminent relationship, of course, is our relationship to the Lord, our relationship to the Lord Jesus Christ. But what I love about that passage from John 11, and we could spend a lot more time on it, but I mean, Mary and Martha are like angry at Jesus. And Jesus is not scolding them for that. He enters into it. There's a proper sadness and anger at death. Jesus is giving voice to that when he weeps. He's ironically showing us how to manage our own emotions before the evil of death. There's something dignifying and beautiful about that. And that's why it's so dangerous when we turn a deaf ear to the intense emotions of our lives. Because when we ignore those emotions, it's leading us to a false view of ourselves. We're becoming less, not more. It's giving us the illusion of control, when in reality, we're further and further away from who God is calling us to be. Jesus is drawing us into that conversation, not away from it. That's part of what our redemption is doing. As Jesus pulls us into anticipating the full redemption of our bodies. So where do we go from here? Where do we go from here? And Pete Scazzaro is suggesting that we need a new paradigm for discipleship that is no longer just about cognition and the memorization of certain truths, but we need to incorporate the conversation with our full selves, a more holistic grasp and understanding of discipleship. That takes into account our personal stories, that takes into account who we are situated in the relationships that we've lived, in our families, our marriages, with our children, in our vocations, that we need to have a conversation about the bigger story of our life. And that's a huge conversation that could be a whole conference in and of itself. Okay, I'm just trying to get the conversation started for us. But what I love about the iceberg metaphor is that I think it captures the conversation that is at the heart of this integration. Like if there's a bigger conversation we need to have, I'm going to suggest that bigger conversation is like the iceberg underneath the surface with each one of us. And we want to just inhabit this space above the surface. And the scriptures are calling us to have this bigger conversation beneath. And Scazzaro will talk about that. By looking beneath the surface, he means, hey, let's talk about the struggles that are present in our lives. Maybe addictive behavior, whether it's alcoholism or sexual addictions, spending sprees. You know, behaviors we don't want to talk about. He'll speak about how we need to see the past and how it exerts influence in our lives today. Trauma, divorce, abuse. One story from my church in San Antonio, we were doing a conference on sexuality. And that day, this man who was visiting our church for the first time, that was the day he had chosen to start an affair. It was something that he had been flirting with for a while, but that was the day. But mysteriously, he also came to our conference. He was drawn into that conversation by some friends, and that was the beginning of his journey in our church. It took a while before that story was revealed to his wife and then to leaders at our church. I, as the pastor, became involved in that conversation, and he leaned into that affair for a season. They separated for a season. And we kept trying to understand what was underneath it. After a period of maybe 6 or 8 months, we learned that what was underneath all of that was a traumatic event that had happened 10 years earlier that he had never talked about with anyone. And it wasn't until his having that conversation about that trauma that he could begin to do the healing that would lead him away, not only from that affair, but back to being able to have a healthy relationship with his wife. But if we had just said, you know, having affairs, that's not biblical, we might not have gotten there. So if we're going to do the work, we have to look beneath the surface. We have to see how the past continues to exert an influence in our lives today. We have to embrace brokenness and vulnerability. You know, one of the signs of a healthy church is that it's okay to not be okay. Can you not be okay at Trinity Presbyterian Church? Or do we have to be together? Do we have to have it all put together? Receiving the gifts of limits, embracing, accepting grief and loss, that's a big part of being a healthy person. Having the capacity to acknowledge and accept that some things are just profoundly broken and they grieve us. And then cultivating an incarnational model of life and relationship. So incarnational, I mean that we're going to value what happens in the context of relationships. It's not just about the decisions that get made. It's about the processes that we embrace as we go about making those decisions. It's not just about outcomes. It's about the conversations. It's about how we inhabit relationships. Which is another aspect of what he talks about in this book that I think's so helpful, because as I speak about these things, I know that there's all these little end-arounds that are going on in our hearts about how we can avoid this conversation. So here are 10 of them. 10 God-denying tendencies that each person has. We use God to run from God. We ignore the emotions of anger, sadness, and fear. We deny, we die to the wrong things. We deny the past impact on the present. We divide our lives into sacred and secular compartments. We do good instead of we're doing for God instead of being with God. We spiritualize away conflict. We cover over brokenness, weakness, and failure. We live without limits, and we judge other people's spiritual journeys. Again, I'm just trying to, this is the fire hydrant, okay? Just throwing stuff at you. Hopefully some of it will stick. So understand our personal stories, and then I want us to understand that there's a conversation to be had in the context of the church. Because what's more complicated than what's going on inside of your heart? All of your hearts going on with each other. That's church. That's what we're doing in church. We're bringing all of that and putting it into an organization. And this is why there is no perfect church. Because we're all part of it. And we bring all of our baggage. as a church planner, there's this myth. That I now know it's a myth, but there's this idea that, you know, you don't want to go to a church because you have to you inherit all of its baggage. You know, you plant a church, you don't have that, and that's not true. Right, y'all figure that out. When you plant it, you make your baggage. You're gonna have baggage. There's stuff underneath the surface that we have to navigate. And so we need a way for having that conversation. So one of the things I wanted to do in this talk is say, okay, this is important. Emotional health, a conversation about how that's integrated into a bigger conversation about our humanity, ourselves made in the image of God. What I want us to do in the next talk is have a conversation about this, the emotional processes in the church and how we do that work together. And I went over, Brian, I know. But is there a question or two? Yes.
I really enjoyed this. It stirred a lot of topics, but I'll narrow it to two. And you touched on using emotions to... Or you said avoid sadness, I think was your example. Mm-hmm. But I find that the comment, you're being emotional, is used in an aggressive manner, mm-hmm. to basically cut off a conflict resolution discussion. Yeah. And with that, I'd like you to comment on the difference in emotions and passion. Because I feel like sometimes, if you're not monotone, you're considered emotional.
Well, you're exactly right. Sometimes people say you're being emotional as a way to deny a conversation that needs to occur. And I think that's one of the ways we need to get underneath the surface, right? So ways that we shut that conversation down, that's an opportunity for us to explore. That whether that's in a marriage or it's on a session, wherever that conversation emerges, it's complicated in the, with those parties, but creating legitimacy for emotion to be present in relationships, I think is a beginning point. That's one of the things I'm trying to say to us today. Is it's okay, like, let's acknowledge this is part of being human beings. So the second thing is if you have any passion or emotion, then those comments should be suspect. Is that kind of what you were suggesting?
It's overlaying an irrational filter if you use any passion at mm-hmm. all in the way you communicate. I mean, even my hand gestures right now could be considered emotional.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think there is a range of, there's a temperament side of this, what level of emotionality people are comfortable with. You know, there's a lot of different sides of this conversation. But just the idea that if you're different from me, then that doesn't count. And I think maybe this gets at the conversation of sameness and difference. Some of us are more emotional and passionate than others. And rather than accepting those differences, we then create a criteria that says, okay, when you are this way, you can't talk, or your opinions are less mature, they're less sophisticated, they're less reliable. Those kinds of biases. And I think, yeah, we should be alerted to those kinds of distinctions. So. Yes.
Me and Alistair have a whole bunch of books, and the Pete whatever, that Dan Allender has a whole bunch of books, mm-hmm. and then Pete, I can't pronounce his last name.
Pete Scazzaro.
Yeah, there's like 8 books in that series. Like, if you were going to pick one book for like our personal relationships from both Dan Allender and the Pete guy, which ones would you?
So I would pick 2 from Dan Allender.
Okay.
It's not fair.
I love it. I like books.
So The Bold Love and The Cry of the Soul. So Bold Love, which is a book specifically talking about the conversation of relationships. The Cry of the Soul is a book more specifically oriented to the darker emotions that we all have, and having a biblical conversation with ourselves about, like, sadness, jealousy, anger, loneliness, those betrayal, those kinds of things. And he looks specifically at the Psalms of Lament. And so they're doing 2 different things. So that the other with Scazzaro, his recent book, The Emotionally Healthy Leader, is fantastic, but I wouldn't read that one. I would just start with The Emotionally Healthy Church.
Personal.
Yep, I would just do that.
Okay. I've read his wife's one, The Emotionally Healthy Woman, and it's a great book.
Yeah. That the first edition of that book was called I Quit, and that was when she left the church. She left his church 3 times. Her husband's church 3 times. So, Jeanette, you know, I don't know. You might want to have a conversation with Tara, my wife. So, okay, one more question back in the back.
Hello. Thank you so much for coming to speak with us last night and this morning. Speaking to what you were saying earlier about deterrence to discussing conflicts, like you're being emotional, something that I feel like I've encountered or my peers have encountered is misappropriation of the scripture of respecting your elders. Something I've encountered is... There he is. That's the guy I want to talk about. No, I'm kidding. No. With my Christian walk and many of my peers, we've been blessed with many elders where their wisdom is very apparent, their patience is... but much more plentiful than we are deserving of, or at least in my walk. But I've also kind of encountered, and it seems to be increasing over time, the use of respect your elders almost as a deterrent, where you try to convey like your conflict or what you're feeling, and whatever elder, let's just say like parents, grandparents, or any relatives will say, oh yes, it's what you're encountering is this thing I already encountered 20 years ago. This is your plug answer. There's nothing to talk about here. You disagree, and they say they're disrespecting. You're disrespecting them,
right?
And their judgment, and that's been a roadblock that I and others I know have encountered. Do you have any advice about like how to traverse that, or if we're going to talk about that at all, or when encountering something like that?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think that question will be more better. It'll better fit with the next talk.
Okay.
So I'm going to wait, and then bring it back up after that talk, because we'll have more stuff to kind of interact with to answer that question.
Sounds good.
Okay. All right. Let's take a break. Please read the section from Creating a Healthier Church, another great book by Ronald Richardson, and we'll come back at